Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks, on this Aloha Friday, September 12th. Today we're bringing you a Hanaho show, showcasing stories of those who left their homeland to start new lives in Hawaii. We share stories of resilience and cultural impact. Did you know that before sugar and pineapple dominated agricultural fields, early Chinese farmers fed the island economy by growing rice? We sit down with a descendant of Sakatas, remembering the early Filipino contract laborers who made significant contributions to Hawaii's plantation industry. We explore Hawaii's German connection. Hats off to business mogul Heinrich Hackfeld, an entrepreneur who came before Liberty House and AmFac. And we talk to an author whose book documents stories around the Portuguese in Hawaii, The Threads That Bind Us, Understanding Beloved Traditions, and more.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Theater Center, presenting The Moth, October 3rd, celebrating the diversity and commonality of human experience in an evening of storytelling. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
Hawaii Public Radio is more than just radio. HPR shares stories about our islands that give us hope, hosts events that bring us closer together, and delivers music that grounds us when we need it most. Best of all, HPR is powered by you. Support it by donating $10 a month at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today we share a Hanaho show highlighting stories about early immigration to our islands. We start with Chinese historian and author Douglas Chong, who can trace his heritage to rice farmers who lived here on Oahu. One of his books, Ancestral Reflections, Hawaii's Early Chinese in Waipahu, details the rice industry from 1895 to 1935. Chong shares a forgotten, rich history of rice and its contribution to our island economy. Before corn seed and before sugar was king in Hawaii, there was the reign of rice.
We have been in Hawaii for 9 generations, and the local Chinese here in Hawaii have a very unique situation because 70% of the Chinese come from only one small county in China, which is Zhongshan County. And as that, we have the largest Zhongshan population in the world. I would dare say even outside of China, including China, because in China, most of the villages have been depleted of our local people who have moved off to better and, bigger things in China. But in Hawaii, they have stayed. And as such, families trace their history down to 7 to 10 generations already in Hawaii, and we all come from one area. And very little has ever been really researched and written. And so 50 years ago, the Hawaii Chinese History Center started. And we started to encourage our researchers and show them how to research to the point where we could get our writers to write about their family history, their heritage, and what it means to them to being American Chinese growing up in Hawaii and how their ancestors came to the islands. As such, we have put out almost 4 dozen books on the Chinese of Hawaii, written by the Chinese themselves. And we still carry on our heritage and our history, as very few Chinese can track their original history that far back. And when they come to our history center, we can help them and show them how, because Hawaii's Chinese population is so small due to the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Now, I was driving toward the North Shore and happened to stop at Ching's store in Punalu and was delighted to see on their wall the incredible history of rice in Punalu.
Punalu was only one of the very, very many centers of rice growing. On Oahu, we had Waikiki, Makiki, Palolo, Manoa, Pearl City, Waiau, Waiava, Waipio, Waipahu, Laie, Haula, Punalu, Kahana, Waikani, Kahalu, Kailua, Kaneohe, all of them. All of this area was all in rice planting at the turn of the century. Rice planting began very early in the 1860s. The Chinese left the sugar plantations and started their stint with working with the Hawaiians, recapturing their lands. It was a very opportune time because acres of taro land lay fallow as the native population dwindled. And so the Chinese went in there, settled among the Hawaiians, restored their taro and fish ponds, taro lands and fish ponds, and took a lot of the area to drain and clear to grow their rice. Once they started their rice, more and more Chinese laborers came into the islands to help with the rice planting. They went into the areas closer to the sea, so they never affected the sugar plantations, which began much later on, about 30 years later, before the rice sugar plantations really started to take off. They took the upper lands, the drier lands, whereas we took the lower lands and the areas among the streams and the flatlands that had artesian wells.
Now, I know there is an area just off the Pali Highway as you go into Kailua, that Heiau, where the community is restoring the lohi, the taro patches.
Yeah, that was all in rice. That whole area was in rice. And Kailua, especially because it had the lower land, the one that always floods, and we also had all the valleys. Up here in the valleys, we used all the valleys up in Kailua. It was because we had so much water. We had access to water. And the valleys were very, very prized because of the water. And also, a lot of the land could be terraced, much like it is in China.
You mentioned artesian wells, and I think there's a spring over there in Mo'ili'ili.
That's right. In Mo'ili'ili, Sheridan Street area, that whole area had artesian wells. And we had them in Waipahu area. And that made it much, much easier, because where you could not, or it was more humbug trying to separate the streams and getting the water to the rice and taro fields, the artesians, wells would just bubble up and give you free access to the water.
And I'm trying to think of the name of that restaurant there.
Willows.
Willows Restaurant,
yes. That's right,
the stream.
That's right. So that whole area was also in rice planting. We have many pictures of the whole Makiki Waikiki area showing Diamond Head in rice and showing Punch Bowl area in Makiki. That whole area was in rice.
Now, over in Waipahu, at the plantation village there, I understand that you've started a tradition there of actually planting rice as a part of that history?
Yes. Well, we have it just mainly for our museum. We have a very beautiful Victorian mansion there that we rebuilt there at the Waipahu Cultural Garden Park with our Chinese Society House, which is really called a Chinese temple now, and a very large original cookhouse that's still standing from 1912. And as part of our display, we show how the laborers lived there. There we had, amongst the Victorian houses, we had some bungalows where these single Chinese laborers would live there. They'd work there. There was even a death house there. And for part of the display, we do cultivate rice just to show our visitors what rice looked like, because Waipahu started their rice plantations long before the sugar came in at the turn of the century. And we had that whole area, the lower area, the upper area, the side area, the Waipio area, Hawaii, Waipio, the whole area was in rice. So it was one of the largest, we had one of the largest Chinese communities next to Chinatown itself, because we had rice, we had sugar, and we grew hasu or lotus root and vegetables and poultry, and we restored all the fish ponds. So it was a thriving Chinese community there.
Now, I had the wonderful opportunity of attending a dinner that was hosted by one of the Chinese societies, and on the table was a small bag of rice paying homage to the roots of the members of that society. And I understand that that group is, you know, the one that's responsible for maintaining the grave sites of those bachelor rice farmers from way back when there in Punalu.
Well, yeah, that is the Punalu Institute. We started in 1906 as a Chinese debate society, And we are still in existence today. So that is the party that you attended. And it's a very old society. And the descendants of all the Chinese who live there still operate the organization. Now, that grave site there is not only for bachelors, but it represents all the different families that lived and died among the area, because there are actually four major burial sites in the Punalu area. Collectively, we have designated just one area with two different graves as being the venerated ancestor, although there are other graves and other grave sites there in Punalu that we had. And it was actually designated quite late in history that we designated that area, because the earlier area was on the seashore where the Chinese started to bury, but then the tide started to come in, so they decided to move the area further up in the mountains. And that's the area that we have designated as our ancestral memorial.
And in doing my research, I understand that that land is owned by Kamehameha Schools.
Usually, it's just the one time in April that we go up there for Qingming. But a few weeks before that, we have people help us go up there and clean the grave site area.
Well, I was really impressed, you know, in just, you know, a little afternoon jaunt up there on that side of the island to learn that history, because it's all there on the walls. And you have a wonderful little kind of a loop video that plays talking about the history of the valley.
Right. I did that many years ago, with about 2006, on the centennial of our club. And I put together this video on all the different Chinese people, the Chinese families that settled there. And it's very interesting, because in Punalu, it was highly, I'd say about 95% of all the rice farmers were from only one small district of an 8-mile radius within Zhongshan County itself. And we all spoke only one dialect, which is almost totally extinct. I still speak it, but I can only speak it with the three living people who still speak that dialect. But within that, we had a microcosm, because it was just like the village area that we came from, and we all settled together. We all decided to settle together. And all of those families, as their children grew up, they used to match marry, like the Wongs would marry the Lums, or the Lums would marry the Chings, or the Yuans would marry the Lums, and back and forth and back and forth. But they were all one kind of people. They were all the Namlong people from the Zhongshan area. So it was a subculture in another subculture, which defines Hawaii.
And were you able to make the trek back to your village?
When I was much younger, I was very fortunate, you know, the first time I got back there, because a lot of the old people were still there, so I conducted a lot of research. And it was wonderful, because China was closed for so long. The stories that I heard as a child of 8 or 9, I used to write them down before Alex Haley even started his roots. The stories of my grandmother and her sister who went to the California Gold Rush, you know, they used to sit down and tell me these stories about things happening here and in China. And long after they had died, I finally got back to China the month after Mao Zedong had passed away. And I finally got back to the village, and I found a very old man, and we were just sitting there in the heat and talking stories. And he wasn't too, you know, he wasn't too open to talk. So I swung into our native dialect, and he just smiled up, and he said, "You're from overseas?" I said, "Yeah, I'm staying at my great-grandmother's house." And when I told him about that, he nearly cried. He said, "You know, I know them so well that I was with your granduncle when he died." And he started telling me the exact same stories that my grandmother had told me when I was a child. So, you know, it just brought this all back. And I got to sleep in my great-grandmother's house, and all her things, her pictures were on the wall, and all the dishes, things that she had brought back from Punalu were still there in the house. So we still have a very, very strong connection. Many of the books that we've written are based on what we call oral history. And oral history is far more enlightening than written history many times, because it deals with the ordinary and the everyday people and their trials, tribulations of making a life in a new country. And I think that more than ever, what we want people to do is to realize the experiences that they went through, to be thankful, and to retain a lot of their values, their histories, the things that made them unique, that made them Chinese, because after all, it is their identity. And more, rice farming is not easy. It's not easy at all. And where we come from in Zhongshan, we did the same thing. We pushed these crops. We pushed two crops a year. And to push two major crops a year, that was hard work because it's not only clearing the land and then planting the seeds and then harvesting, and fertilizing and chasing the rice birds with the musket and tin cans and then harvesting with the sickles and cutting your hand with them. And it was hard work. And even ladies like my great-grandmother and my grandmother with bound feet would go out and help them. And they'd winnow the rice and everything until they had the rice mills really going. It was a lot. It was labor intensive. And that's the very reason why we lost it in the late 1920s. By then, the Chinese laborers were nearly all dead or retired. They were too old to work the fields. Mm. And because of the exclusion law, we could not bring in any more Chinese who'd continue. Also, pestilence had, the pests and the weevils had gotten into the rice crops, and it was no longer profitable. Mm-hmm. So that whole thing died out about that area. By the 1920s, by 1930, there was nothing left. And the Japanese took over the few areas in Kauai, in the valleys, to grow the mochi rice. But there was no more rice after that.
That was Douglas Chong, author and Chinese historian, talking about the reign of rice here on Oahu. The story originally aired in November of 2020. And last year, the Honpa Hongwanji Mission of Hawaii recognized Chong as a living treasure of Hawaii. He was honored for his 50 years of dedicated work preserving Hawaii's Chinese history and sharing his cultural heritage around the world. It was nearly 120 years ago that 15 Filipino plantation laborers called Sakatas arrived in Honolulu. They sailed aboard the SS Doric on December 20, 1906. For the next four decades, the Hawaiian Sugar Planters Association would heavily recruit Ilocanos from the Philippines to work in pineapple and sugar plantations throughout the islands. Pa'o'ilo resident Romel Dela Cruz, who is the descendant of Sakatas, shared family stories with the Conversation's Lillian Song back in 2022. His maternal grandfather was the first to arrive in 1918, followed by six uncles. His father finally arrived in 1946 with the last wave of Sakatas.
My father, Benigno Dela Cruz, came with the last batch in 1946. 6,000 of them were recruited and brought in right after World War II. In anticipation of the strike that was called by the ILWU. In fact, they were brought in as strike breakers, but my dad said that while on board the ship, the USS Manawili, they were actually recruited already to be members of the union. They were told that there was going to be a strike, and they were persuaded that if they did not join, conditions in the sugar plantation will remain the same, low wages and poor labor conditions. And so practically all of them, walk out along with the regular employees. My father arrived in April 1946, and the strike occurred, I believe, it began in September 1946, lasted for 90 days. That's what he told me. He started out, as most Filipinos, in the cane fields as a cane cutter. In fact, that's why the Filipinos were brought, to cut cane, because at that time, when in the early 20s and 30s, the plantations were not totally mechanized yet at that point. But because of the success of the strike that took place in 1946, labor conditions changed. And this allowed a lot of the Filipinos who were manual laborers, primarily cane cutting, to be trained and to operate machines like caterpillars and cane truck driver, which my father became upon his retirement. He was a truck driver. Worked approximately almost 40 years. In the plantation.
So your dad was living through pivotal times. Did he actually leave the Philippines as a single male?
No, he was already married. Remember, it was during the war, World War II, started December 7, 1941. And in 1943, he married my mom. They had me January 27, 1945. And when my father came, he worked hard, sent money home to support his family. And in 1953, he became an American citizen. And he told my mother, well, you know, I think you guys should come. So my mother and I joined him in November of 1954. And all my uncles returned home. My father is the only one that stayed in Hawaii and raised a family.
Did you also live on the plantation? Did you have like plantation housing?
Oh, yes. When my mother and I arrived, we had to stay in a communal house with three other single men until there was a house available for my mother and my sister and I to move into. And yes, I worked summertime in the plantation as a cane cutter, also what they call a poison gang, where you carry the herbicide tank on your back and you spray the weeds and things like that. So yes, all my summers throughout high school and first 2 years in college, I worked in a plantation. They gave us jobs to work. And so I had that experience working in the field. And it was in the fields that I encountered a lot of the cigars and a lot of the old. And those guys were all mainly single men and would say to me, son, you don't want to work with us. You got to get out of here. Get an education. And they were my inspiration. You know, they told me, you don't want to be here with us. You get an education and, you know, get a good job and that kind of stuff.
So having the uncles, the cicadas, actually advising you against manual labor, working in the cane field.
Right.
In what direction did you take then?
Well, my parents, although my father never went beyond the second grade or my mother second year in high school, they always valued education. My father supported relatives in the Philippines to go to college. In fact, the first person in my family to go to college was because of my dad and my uncle that was here in Hawaii. And when it was time for me to go, I guess my parents believed that if your relatives, your cousins in the Philippines can get a college education, there is no reason why you should not get a college education. And that was my motivation. And that's also a lot of the people in the plantation, non-Filipinos as well, who saw potential in certain things that I did, that they encouraged my parents to make sure that I did go to school and get a college education.
Where did you go to college?
I graduated from Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles with a BA in history and a master's in public health from the University of Hawaii, Manoa. And I became a hospital administrator for the state of Hawaii. My last posting was at the Hilo Medical Center in Hilo. And then Haleho'ola Hamakua, which is the hospital in my hometown of Honoka'a, for me, it was a 360 degrees. I went home to manage that hospital in my hometown. And one of the greatest rewards that I had was when those older sub-artists would come into the hospital, because we had a long-term care facility in that hospital as well. That was my crowning point. It was like giving back to my own community taking care of them in their twilight years. Yeah. So to me, that was kind of payback for me, and very lucky and fortunate that I had that opportunity. And not too many people have that, you know, to go back to where they grew up and to help those people that paved the way for them in their future life.
So you had your own coming of age. For you to see the cicadas that, you know, you remembered in the field now coming back, and with your expertise, with the education that you gained to help them, what was that like?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you could see how proud they were that, you know, one of theirs would be running the hospital in their community. That was kind of the crowning point for some, to know that we can become leaders in our community if given the opportunity through education. And I think if you will talk to other Filipino people about my age in 60s, 70s. The 1946ers were a different type of cicadas as well. They were more educated. They were ambitious. They had families. That's the one thing. A lot of the Filipinos that came in the early 20s and 30s were single men, you know, and they had no families. But the ones in 46, most of them were married. And those who were not went back to the Philippines and got married and brought back young wives and fathered a lot of new Filipinos, American Filipinos in Hawaii.
Was your dad one of the last four in that part of the Big Island?
Yeah, he was the last remaining of the four Takatas in Pa'awilo. My father lived to be 22 days short of his 102nd birthday in 2015. There are only two remaining Takatas on the Big Island now, and they're in their late 90s, and soon we will lose all of them. And I think remembering them December 20 collectively, I think, is very important. And I should mention that we have a monument dedicated to Takatas and the Big Island in a place called Keauau. It used to be known as Ula'a. And it's right in front of the Long's Drugstore in Keauau, a statue carved out of bluestone by a son of a Takata, Dr. Fred Soriano, who was a professor at the University of Hawaii, Hilo, and Hawaii Community College. And it stands very proudly at that site. And every December 20, plan is to go and put a lei. And we have done that in the past, but we haven't done much celebration because of COVID. But maybe next year we'll resume that again.
All right. And how will you be celebrating with your family?
We have an event at the Malia Puku Catholic Church in Keokaha, and there will be a little ceremony in remembrance of the Takatas. In addition, we have already prepared the statue, cleaned it up, you know, and there will be some flowers and probably some lace placed on that monument.
Wonderful, wonderful memories. Thank you so much for sharing and helping me just learn more. And anything else that you want to share that we haven't touched on?
Oh, maybe I should share. I did not share the story about how my family ended up in Hawaii, and this is quite unique. See, my father was the last child in the family, and he had nothing material wealth except a bicycle that was given to him by his brother who returned to the Philippines just before World War II. And when I was born, and my mother and I, that was the family and the bicycle. And my father came to Hawaii because of that bicycle. He found out that one of his friends who already had all his papers and documents ready to come to Hawaii changed his mind. And so my father went to him and told him, why don't I give you my bicycle and give me your documents? And that's how my dad came to Hawaii. It wasn't his name that he used. It was the name of this man who had documents. So my father, his name was Benigno de la Cruz, and the name of the gentleman who gave him the paper was Ricardo. The guy was 21 years old. My father was 32, so he had to play a lot of games getting on board the ship. By the way, his last name was de la Cruz, too, so that makes it easier. And that's how we ended up in Hawaii. I have four grandchildren, and when I tell them, our family came to Hawaii because of that bicycle, Grandpa Apo, which is the name for an elderly family member who is honored. I tell them that story, and they said, Papa, how can that be? And I said, Apo came on a bicycle. He traded his bicycle for papers to come to Hawaii, and that's how we came to Hawaii.
That is such a lovely family story to share. And so wonderful to know that your genealogy, if it weren't for that bicycle, he wasn't able to trade up, in a sense, right?
Yeah. And in fact, I tell my kid, you know, keep riding that bicycle because it might lead you, us, our family, to other exciting things, adventure, and maybe more success.
That was Pa'u'ilo resident Romel de la Cruz with HPR's Lillian Song talking about his family's rich plantation history. This interview first aired in 2022, and we should note that the youngest Takata to arrive in the islands, Juan Johnny Visoria Trinidad, died in February of this year. We'll have links to Maribel Apuya's documentary, The Takata Series, on the conversation page of HBR's website. You're listening to a Hanaho show about immigrant communities in Hawaii, a slice of diverse cultures and people who call the islands home. Coming up after the break, we'll hear about early arrivals from Germany and Portugal. Stay with us. Thank you.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters' 15th anniversary celebration, online September 18th to 21st, featuring Kona Noir, Kau Yellow Bourbon, and more. BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com/anniversary.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. We were already excited to come to Honolulu to do two shows at the Blaisdell Concert Hall, but now we're beside ourselves with excitement because on October 9th, we'll be joined by ukulele virtuoso Taimane, and on October 10th, we get to talk to Olympic gold medal surfer Carissa Moore. I just feel sorry for the people who have to decide which one to go to. For tickets, hey, maybe to both, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/waitwait.
Sponsored by Honolulu Financial Partners and Hawaii Pacific University.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Airlines, now with more destinations in partnership with Alaska Airlines, serving the islands for 95 years and committed to serving Hawaii for the next generations to come. HawaiianAirlines.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the conversation on this Aloha Friday. Next month marks the anniversary of a German business that opened its doors on the waterfront of our Honolulu back in 1849. Heinrich Hackfeld was the entrepreneur whose companies would be taken over by American Factors, AmFac, one of the big five in Hawaii's business scene. All that remains of a history is a gate in a shady mini park across from Aloha Tower. Back in 2019, we spoke with Dennis Sale, the Honorary Consul for Germany.
I think most people do not know or remember that Hawaii has a quite interesting German history. In the 1850s, German mercantile business people came from northern Germany, more or less by coincidence, to partake in the boom in whaling and later in the boom in sugar. Some of these people, their names are still visible in town. One of them is Eisenberg.
Or as
we would say, Eisenberg. Another, of course, is Pflüger. There are a couple of other places where you can still find some traces of German influence here, some street names that are not so well known, as, for instance, the Von Hamm Street.
Where's that?
It's in Pacific Heights, I think. Yeah. There are a couple more. There are some bridges named after Germans, but really the German influence here is almost eradicated. It's not celebrated and it's not visible to, you know, the unknowing eye. What I'm trying to do is to at least save the probably most prominent structure in Honolulu that represents German history, and that is the Hackfeld Gate, which sits at what is known as Walker Park, right across from Aloha Tower and adjacent to the Topa Tower. Most people, if you ask them if they know the Hackfeld Gate, will tell you that they don't. When you then describe where it is, everybody's seen it. It's that greenish, beautiful wrought iron gate that sits in this park right opposite of the fountain. And unfortunately, it's been sitting there 45 years or so, and it's rusting. It's only a few feet from the ocean, and I would love to preserve it.
So what do we need to do?
We need to collect some money. It'll cost us about $50,000 to dismount it and sandblast it and then recoat it with a special kind of paint. And to do that, I've been working for about a year and a half to get a permit, which I now have. And I am now trying to collect some money.
So tell us about Heinrich Hackfeld and how his business came to be on that waterfront.
So Heinrich Hackfeld is an amazing person. From everything I could gather, he was born in near Bremen, northern Germany. His parents were poor laborers, and somehow he managed to get a seafarer's education. He, as soon as he turned 16, went on board ship and traveled throughout the world as a ship worker. I don't really know what exactly he did, but over time, he made a captain. And his explorations went further and further. The trip that's most meaningful was the one where he was sailing from Germany to China via Mexico, and he shipwrecked in the Philippines. His ship was loaded with gold and very valuable items, also some sandalwood and other things. Miraculously, the staff survived, and so did the cargo. And he then managed to get another ship to sail all this stuff back to Bremen. And he landed in Hawaii on that return trip. He was so impressed that he sent messages back to Bremen and said, here is a major opportunity. We got to come to Hawaii and start business here. Only that nobody listened. And so he went back to Bremen, now pretty much a broke guy because he didn't sell his stuff. And he had to start over. He did that within a year. And by 18, this shipwrecking happened in 1847. By 1849, he was back in Hawaii with a fully loaded ship and started business at Queen Street.
I mean, that's incredible to think that, you know, this month we're marking, you know, the time when he opened his doors because he wanted to be here, be a part of this community.
That's right. October 1st, 1849. He opened his store at 4th Street. He then purchased a store that he previously had rented. The company then profited from the whaling boom for the first 10 years and then soon after got into sugar. And sugar really propelled Hochfeld into another sphere. They initially started the shipping of sugar to the mainland, but then quickly got into what was called factoring. And factoring is nothing else than to buy the accounts receivable from the plantation and get that as a discount and then sell the receivables to the people that got the sugar from the plantations. So they basically inserted themselves in the middle, which was a very common practice at the time. It's almost like banking. Their arms then reached to back to Europe, to other countries in Europe, and, of course, to the mainland U.S. as well as Russia.
And there was another famous name in sugar, Klaus Spreckels, right?
Klaus Spreckels, yeah, he was probably mightier than anyone else in this industry. Spreckels, not directly related to Hochfeld, and I haven't been able to figure out if these two guys actually ever interacted. To my best knowledge, Spreckels was a very private person and did not really get into the German community, which was on Oahu, whereas Spreckels was really more in Maui. However, Spreckels was very involved with the royal family and very influential in politics in Hawaii. And then later reinvented the sugar industry altogether in California by not using sugar cane, but the root, and became incredibly rich.
Mr. Hochfeld, though, his success in Hawaii unfortunately did not last. Well, his assets got seized, right?
This is probably the most interesting aspect of the whole story as far as I'm concerned, because the German community that came here in the 1850s and 60s and Hochfeld really got entangled in 1914 with World War I events. Obviously, they were not part of any kind of warfare, or I'm not even sure they were sympathizing with the imperial government in Germany that waged the war on the rest of Europe and by 1917, America. But Hochfeld's nephew at that point in the 1910s was Johann Hochfeld, who was the consul for Germany in Honolulu. And at the same time, German imperial ships were chased out of the Pacific by the Japanese. Interestingly enough, the Japanese at that time were allies with the U.S. And so we had a lot of German ships here, and stuff started happening. Loyalty questions came up amongst the Hawaiians. Initially, the Germans were really welcome, the German sailors that landed here fleeing from the Japanese. But over time, and as the war got more gruesome, the favor pendulum swung in the other direction. And by 1917, it was decided that Hochfeld's company had to be dissolved. There was an entity called the Alien Property Custodian. They deemed any German property to be unworthy in the United States. And at that time, Hawaii, of course, was still a territory, but had been moved so close after the abolishment of the kingdom to the U.S. that Germany was no longer welcome. So the custodian took the company, dissolved it, and sold it to its competitors.
And that later became?
AmFac.
AmFac.
American Factors.
Right. And his store later became Liberty House. And, you know, it just that history, that thread, but it was his success as a businessman here in this community.
Correct. Yes. So the Liberty House story is that another person related to Hockfeld, all of these Germans were ultimately somewhat related because they all came from Bremen. So B.F. Ehlers is the original store in Fort Street that then existed for quite some time as a clothing garment store. As the American factors were put in place of Hockfeld, B.F. Ehlers became Liberty House at the same foul swoop, basically.
That's great
and,
history.
Yeah. Ehlers was related. I think he was a nephew of Hockfeld.
That was Dennis Sahle, Honorary Counsel for Germany in the Islands, spotlighting the German connection in our history. For links to read more about the historic gate, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. We close our show today with a story on the first Portuguese immigrants in Hawaii. Laborers from Madeira were some of the first to come on a ship called the Priscilla. September 30th will mark the 147th anniversary of the ship's arrival. The Portuguese immigrants aboard that German ship were the first wave of sugar plantation workers. We originally aired this segment in May of 2023. It was about a book called Portuguese in Hawaii, detailing Hawaii's ties to Portugal. Kailua resident Danny Abreu recalls how he first connected with author and filmmaker Nelson Ponta Garza.
I first met Nelson on a social media post that there was this film producer coming to the Hawaiian Islands and going to the Big Island in Kona, and he was going to do a story on the Portuguese in Hawaii, on, you know, the different areas of work and the different areas of business and politics and so on. So I reached out to him on that post after discovering that, you know, he's a producer. He's interviewed many governors and mayors. He interviewed Anthony Bourdain. At one point in time, he's interviewed several dignitaries across the U.S. and probably around the world. And so I says, oh, wow, he's the real McCoy. And I would love to host him if he would ever come to Honolulu, and informed him that my mom has been a genealogist of 50 plus years and that we would absolutely love to meet up with him. Anyway, Nelson did his thing on the Big Island and did some wonderful stories and captured the different Portuguese that worked there and lived there. And then 2 years later, early in the morning, one morning, as I was at my computer, my phone had a couple of texts. And I looked at it and I said, Nelson Ponta Garza from São Jorge, Azores, is coming to Honolulu. We met, we're just like family, and we had the same dream to preserve and protect and honor our ancestors that traveled across many oceans and many seas and sacrificed and left their homeland understanding never to return. And many never caught the ship to Hawaii, and many never did return, and some moved on to the mainland. So that's how I met Nelson, and that's our humble beginnings.
And Nelson, jump in here. So you must meet, you know, lots of people like Danny who are just passionate about where they came from and the stories behind why they left Portugal.
Yes, I did. But Hawaii was very special. I did this on the project. I've been working for many years for Portuguese National TV with news and entertainment content as a host and as a producer. I created a brand called Portuguese Inn that would go try to preserve the history and give visibility to the Portuguese in the main areas across, especially America. Me being born in America but raised in Portugal, I did Portuguese in California, in New England, and then about 5 years ago, I did a documentary called Portuguese in Hawaii. We did showings in the Big Island, and then from there, it developed into having something more physical that people could have in their hands and would really stay forever in a book. So we printed this book. It came here all the way from Portugal.
Well, what makes Hawaii different maybe from the other places that you've studied?
I felt a connection, very strong connection, when I first got to the Big Island here. And the reason is especially the trip. I think once I did this documentary, it was very, very appreciated in Portugal, had a lot of media attention because Hawaii is very far from Portugal and somehow disconnected. The Portuguese are very invisible in a way here. They adapted, they married with different ethnic groups, and it's kind of disappearing, the Portuguese heritage, but it is a very strong heritage here, and I believe it's very different because they came to not go back, and they came with their families. If you look at the migration in California, New England, and other areas, especially Brazil, France, where the Portuguese went, they keep going back and forward, and some of them just came, made some money, then went back to their original country. And here to Hawaii, you're counting already 5, 6, 7 generations that came, adapted, and never went back. But you can still feel some of that presence, whether if it's from the malasadas or it's from the different things that you have here that everybody knows. The Portuguese really had a big impact all the way back to the Priscilla days when they got here back in 1878. They were one of the first ethnic groups here, and I think they adapted really well and have a huge contribution, and we wanted to document that in a book and in a documentary with people of Portuguese descent in different areas, from comedy to business to organizations in different areas. And I just made so many friends here. I'm really happy to be back here for the 4th, 5th time. It's very similar to Azores and Madeira, and the way it looks, the way the people are so warm, hosting me every time I come here. And Danny was as a producer of this book, was able to make this dream happen of having this documentary also in a book that we're releasing here.
Well, Danny shared that, you know, his family's from Madeira, and I've known that my father's from Madeira, and I have ties to the Azores from my mother's side. So I look forward to the day that I can travel to Portugal and visit these places.
Yes, we would love to have you there, and I think more and more Hawaiians have been going back, and Danny was one of them, and others have going back to Madeira and Azores, and that is a very common combination. We have the Azores Islands, there's 9 islands, very similar to Hawaii, even on the distribution of the islands. Then you have Madeira, that is just one big island. And when I interviewed more than 50 people throughout the islands, one of the combinations that was very common is they would tell me, oh, mama from Madeira, papa from Azores, or the other way around, they were not sure, but it always came across like that combination. And the main reason was because, you know, there was a lot of poverty and a lot of hardship back then. But they were very good in the whaling industry and also in the sugarcane. And Hawaii needed people to work on that area. And all the way back to King Kalakaua, there was a very good understanding with the Portuguese people because they would bring their families and they would stay, as other ethnic groups would come kind of for the adventure or just to check it out. The Portuguese came with their families and just stayed. And it was good for the sugarcane plantations because they would be solid workers that would come and stay, become lunas, and then contribute to the development of Hawaii.
And Danny, what was it like when you first went back to Portugal, you know, to see where your family was from?
Yeah, I think the most impactful thing is as I was walking through the streets in downtown Funchal, and I had a tear in my eye, and my wife looked at me and she says, oh, what's the tears for? And I says, I feel like my ancestors are here. The other significant thing is that, you know, being in Hawaii with so many diverse cultures and being a former McDonald's executive, I work with all kinds of races and ethnicities. And being there and seeing everybody's Portuguese, I mean, everybody looked like me. And people would look at me and they says, you're Portuguese? And I said, yes, I am. And although I would be a little bit teased being in Madeira, because when they hear my last name, Abreu, they say, shame on you. How come you don't speak Portuguese? Well, the language is lost in Hawaii. And I wasn't, you know, language wasn't taught, you know, back in the day. So obviously, you know, I spoke Japanese. That's the course of language that I chose to take in high school because I was in the restaurant business and working in Waikiki as well. So the Japanese obviously helped me in my profession. But yeah, the significance of the beauty, the people there, everybody speaks English. Everybody helps you. The food obviously is a big tie with their bulo de kako, the bulo de mel, the bacalhau, the espatada. I mean, it's a whole different culture when you go there. I have some very good friends that I've been in touch with, and I have some other social media websites that I stay connected to Portugal, Madeira, and the Azores Islands. So it's heartfelt. It's hard to describe. When you go there, you feel that my ancestors are thanking me for returning the trip, because they sacrificed so much. That, you know, one ship is 66 days. One ship is 82 days. The Sterling Shire was 112 days to come to Hawaii, and I just can't imagine, after looking at the prior documentaries where people sacrifice so much and arrive for the new promised land and were told that now you speak English. The elders obviously spoke Portuguese, but they didn't teach the offspring, because now you're American citizen, you speak English.
Yeah, I know that line.
It's a sense of belonging. Once you go to Madeira or Azores Islands or Portugal, it's a sense of belonging.
That was Kailua resident Danny Abreu and author Nelson Pontegarsa talking about Portuguese in Hawaii, the history of generations. Our interview first aired in 2023. The Portuguese Culture and Historical Center's gala dinner will take place on September 17th at the Ala Moana Hotel. It's a fundraiser for a community center. We'll have links to learn more on our website later today. Well, that does it for today's special showcase of the cultural mix of early immigrants. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Maybe you have a story to share. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The conversation can be found on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HBR Digital team. Our backyard quiz theme, written for us by John DeMello, theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.